So today the talk is on the ecology of compassion as the interrelationship of our inner world and our outer world. From what I hear and see in my own heart and in the communities I'm connected with, there's a growing deep need for each one of us in our own ways and maybe as groups to help, to do what we can to make this world a better place. I mean, more than ever, I think we feel that because of the quickness of communication and the widespreadness of communication. There's a growing sense of urgency to acknowledge our gifts and to share them with others, to offer what we can, however insignificant we consider them to be. I know a friend of mine, actually she's a friend and Steve's sister, who wants to go to the hospital and just cuddle babies, you know. They call them cuddlers in Maine. I thought that was really nice. I thought, I want to be a cuddler too. I want it to be that simple that I can just go to the hospital ward and hold the babies. But alas, it isn't that simple in my world. But I might still do that. We want to touch the world, of course, which is increasing in its complexity. We have this, maybe we can't name it, but somehow I've come up with, we want to touch it with some kind of simplicity. It's too complex, you know. Can't we just walk when we're walking, smile when we're smiling, touch a person's heart when we touch a person's heart, and not have it any more complicated than that? Can we slow down? You know, it's so going so fast. Can we touch it with slowing down, which is one of the things we do when we come to a thing like this, is we intentionally slow down. And maybe that is creating some balance in the world, like the butterfly in Mongolia that has an effect on us here. The wings of a butterfly, you know, maybe our slowing down are like those wings that touch other people somehow, some way. We want to touch the world with kindness, of course, and we can do that. We're trying our best to do that by finding the kindness within ourselves and nurturing that, being in touch with that, letting that develop and grow. Equally as strong, there is a growing spiritual urgency to go within, to go deep within. That's why we're here together. That's why we do this. And we find support from one another in doing that. To that place of simply recognizing, to that place of simply acknowledging the inner landscape without overlaying anything on it at all. Maybe a simple note of, this is just breathing in, or a simple note of, hearing is happening, that's all, or a simple note of, smelling is happening, or being known, that's all. Knowing that inner landscape, sadness, anger, without acting upon it or acting it out. Simply the honesty that we develop and strengthen of knowing what's going on without resisting it. Because when this happens, we less and less project that reactivity or that activity in the mind. We don't reactivate that in the world. You know, what's going on in the mind is not reacted upon. That it's just this activity here. We don't have to project it out in the world. It's sometimes so strikingly and shockingly known in a moment to me how whatever situation I'm in is, I'm just caught in a bunch of projections. It's not like what is really going on it's not that. It's just like what everybody thinks is going on. There's just this projection of this and even my added projection on that and somebody else's. And I'm just living in this world of a kaleidoscope of projectors. And it's so shockingly sad to me in that moment. You know, and what is possible for me to do is just to be with the truth of just knowing that in the first place. Just knowing that, not in a blaming way, but just knowing that that is being known. And then knowing the feeling within of that shock or surprise or sadness or sometimes irritation about it. Just the truth of that. To experience a clear view of how it actually is in our hearts is so refreshing. And it's a place where maybe is grounding. And that's what we're learning to do in our practice. This takes a sobering honesty. At times it takes an unflinching courage to lead into life with our hearts and not, you know, our heads. And not that that's wrong. I mean, we have to use our intellect and our knowing and our figuring out and our planning, and it serves us well, but sometimes it's on overdrive and overkill, and touching into our hearts is really important. It takes courage to do that, to see what the underpinnings of the personality, what we call personality, are. What makes up this mind and body continuum called Kamala or Rich or Lindell or Rosie? What makes up that? Can that be noticed without resistance, without another layer of judgment, but just in a clear view of it? This is from Agnes Au. I found this in the Shambhala Sun. It was an article about Buddhist women. And she talks about unlayering this pain, this kind of suffering of knowing this. And she says, "I see this path as actually an invitation to strip naked at one's own pace, and in so doing to experience the vividness of an unfiltered life." The vividness of an unfiltered life. And that's exactly what we're doing here, to experience that vividness, that clear view of life in its unfiltered, unlayered way, not projecting anything on it, or not believing anybody else's projections, no matter how lofty they are. And that's another trap that we can get into. Anybody else's projections of how beautiful, lofty, or whatever it is, we can live in that projection and feel safe for some time. But that's not the total truth. It may be the truth for that person, but the best ways is that our masters, our the Buddhas of the world, the Christs of the world have said that can only show you the way. You yourself have to walk it, have to find the way. So a master points the way, and the yogis, the meditators, try to live that way. The finger pointing to the moon is not the moon. So through this process, we discover what our habitual forces of mind and heart are, and that create this inner terrain. And mindfulness is one of those forces that we learn to strengthen, to grow, to use more and more. Loving kindness is another one that we learn to use as a support in our practice. Each one of us have these to different degrees, and we're working on making them stronger. And how does this inner terrain have an effect on the outer terrain? It's a question we all have. You know, many of you have voiced your concern about that. What am I saying? Is this perpetuating it in the world, in myself? Is it perpetuating it in others? It's a serious and valid concern that we have. How do we stop the continual perpetuation of that. So these are the questions. I'm saying them, I'm putting them out there because I have them too, like you do, and I don't have the answers to all of them. I try to follow a way that can understand them from my own heart. So what habitual forces create an ecology? That's the interrelationship of the inner terrain with the outer terrain. An ecology of peace, harmony, happiness on an individual level, one-to-one, on a social level, groups with other groups. Can we recognize this and incline towards that? Can we nourish that? So just having the question is really important. The answers come in their own way, and sometimes we find ourselves living out answers of wisdom that we didn't even know we had based on just the truth of that question. What inner habitual forces create an ecology of unrest, distress, disharmony, fear on an individual one-to-one level, on a social level, on a worldwide level? Can we be clear about this? Can we accept the times when, we're not nourishing clarity, that we're actually perpetuating confusion, and know that in a neutral, clear way without adding another projection or another layer of difficulty to it that we then have to bear and face and, add to our tangle of knots? So that by accepting this, these forces are recognized swiftly before it affects the mind, before it affects the speech, before it affects our action in the world. What is not nourished is relinquished. And how do we not nourish them? By recognizing them first. And yesterday I spoke of free will and choice. Do we really have free will? Are we acting on patterns that don't serve us in the world? And that's not free will. That's just being an automaton. Spontaneity doesn't really mean free will. Sometimes spontaneity means acting out those old habits. So without doing this inner quiet investigation that we take the time to do when we're doing retreats or quiet times such as this, or even in our own homes, we're clearly seeing an inner landscape that perhaps we don't have the time or the space to see in other situations. How can we ever hope to have a truthful effect on the outer landscape of our world when we're not taking the time to be truthful about the inner landscape? How can we ever hope to touch the world with kindness when we can't give our inner landscape that kindness of knowing that moment? When difficulty comes up within us, it wants to be known. It wants to be touched with the kindness of awareness. Awareness is very kind. Really, when awareness is truly there, metta is very, very nearby. So awareness is truly kind, and even metta is truly has awareness with it. They both support each other. Granted, we may not radically change the world because of this awareness, because of this kindness with our inner landscape. But we change our world. We change what's around us, the people around us. And that makes a big, big difference. When I'm kind and I try to be aware, my grandchildren know. They give me feedback that they know what's happening, or they say nice things to me. They give me compliments that we want to be around and say, "Grandma, you're really a nice person." So I've affected them. I've been a model for them. And they'll grow up and they have a big chance of being a nice person because I'm a nice person. So then they go out and affect people, and, you know, I see each one of you and other grandmas in the room and other grandchildren in the room that affect their grandmas, and, you know, it goes on and on and on. So in this room, there are enough people to affect the whole world, just in this little room. So we have a chance. We really have a chance. So it's not a fact, it's not about affecting the whole world, really. It's if we can just be genuine about transforming our own hearts, that's where the real work is. It sends ripples of goodness out. So it's not about layering a veneer of denial, anger, or righteous indignation or idealism onto the world, that the world should be like this and we've got to change it. And I'm not talking about that, because we change ourselves. We have to change the world. But it just happens that way. The practice we're doing requires a tremendous amount of compassion. And so it's really incumbent upon all of us to remember that compassion every day, in every interaction we have. The Buddha, His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, says, "Compassion doesn't make the atrocities of the world disappear or see them as right. It just stops those atrocities from continuing in our own hearts." You know, the atrocity of blame, and there's even the righteous indignation. You know, that's an atrocity. You know, I don't like to be around people like that. It's, you know, it doesn't work. It doesn't help. People shrivel up. So it's just kindness of understanding even the people who are cruel, understanding who they are really more than their cruelty. There's more to them than that. But of course, their cruelty can also affect us, and so compassion for ourselves. Usually, compassion is thought of in terms of helping or saving others, facing the suffering out there and acting upon it. And we often forget about the suffering that's going on in our own hearts. So true compassion is really remembering all the beings that are suffering out there, including ourselves. Compassion isn't complete, really, unless we can include ourselves. Because when we forget ourselves, then we don't know how cruel we can be sometimes. And we're not helping at all. We may altogether miss a very important first step when we just think about others, and that is the tender-hearted care and willingness to face what's going on in our own hearts. So to develop the courage to open to this truth of suffering in its various manifestations, it takes tremendous compassion. Courage and compassion are sometimes one and the same. The Buddha said, "There is one thing, O monks, the not seeing of, which keeps us bound on this cycle, and that is the noble truth of suffering." The not seeing of the noble truth of suffering keeps us bound on this cycle of suffering. So when we deny it, when we avoid it, when we keep pulling towards it, it shouldn't be this way. You know, it's got to be another way. When that is done with so much righteous indignation, there's, you know, denial there. There's very high level of delusion there. And the Buddha said, that delusion keeps us bound on this cycle. So it's accepting, opening to the suffering. And what we need with that is a tremendous amount of compassion to open to that suffering in ourselves and in others. One of the descriptions frequently given on compassion, or karuna, you might hear that word, karuna, is that this compassion makes our hearts quiver when others are afflicted with sorrow. So it's a quivering of the heart when we see others, or even ourselves, of course, afflicted with pain or sorrow. It's sometimes, for a lot of people, it's a physical feeling. You know, we may think it's fear, but maybe intermittent or within that, or maybe a large part of that, is actually compassion for what's going on. And we just need to really touch it and know that that's there in our hearts. It said that the chief characteristic of compassion is the inclination of our minds, our bodies, our speech to remove that suffering. The inclination of the heart to remove that suffering wherever it is. We may not be able to, but there is some inclination, there's some intention. When I hear, I just read an article about a Tibetan nun who's actually Australian, who is in Mongolia, who's helping the indigent and the poor and orphans in particular. And I wanted to go there right away, you know, when I read this article yesterday. And I wanted to say, can I help you, at least maybe in this time off that I can have? Can I help you? I know I really can't do that, but I'm very aware of the inclination of the heart to do that. That's so important in our world, that we get in touch with that inclination, that intention, even if we can't do it all. Because in some ways that will lessen the feeling of helplessness, which is a big, you know, part of what happens when there's so much suffering. We feel helpless. So know that inclination, know that intention. And that's a strength, that's a goodness. And then when something arises where we can give our help, there'll be a great force coming out of our hearts. Great strength, great force, very effective in doing what we can. And it may be something completely different than that. Maybe helping an elder cross the street with great compassion. So this state of heart and mind that is compassion was the beginning of the 45 years of the dispensation of the Dharma, of the Sasana, the dispensation of the Dharma by the Buddha. It was that very compassion, that strong moment of this wholesome mind and heart state that we are still riding the wave on, you know, almost or now 2,600 years after the Buddha's enlightenment. And there are many others that have fed into that in our own lives, you know, Christ and for me, the Blessed Mary and Mother Teresa and my mother, you know, and my grandmother. And I'm riding on all of that compassion, and you on your own compassionate, whatever has fed into that in your life. So whenever I find it hard to be with the suffering of the world, I try to connect with that. You know, this is what the Buddha's teachings are actually started from that moment of compassion. And whenever I hear the teachings of living in harmony, the teachings on developing a concentrated mind, the teachings on wisdom, on sila, samadhi, panya, I have a deep gratitude for that. All of those teachings are riding on this one strong moment of compassion. So it's very great. It said that the two wings of the Dharma are wisdom and compassion. And one without the other would not be complete. The bird of the Dharma or the teachings of liberation would not really fly. Compassion supports the growth of wisdom. And then that compassion becomes a natural outgrowth from that wisdom. The wisdom is seeing into the true nature of life. And the first step is opening to suffering. It's the first noble truth. Without compassion, we would not be able to open to the truth of suffering. We need a large measure of that. And opening to the truth of suffering opens us to the cause of suffering, opens us to the fact that there is an end to suffering, opens us to the possibility to walk on the path towards the end of suffering, the Eightfold Noble Path. And those are basically the Four Noble Truths, that opening to suffering because of compassion leads to the end of suffering. So our hearts quiver because we can open to the rawness of life. Life isn't all just beautiful, of course. There is that. We need to acknowledge that and open to that, but also to the rawness of it, the helplessness of it, the vulnerability of it. So someone asked me recently, where do you go? What does your mind settle on when it can feel at ease or can feel at peace? And, I could give you a couple of answers, but the one that's most practical is that the mind goes to living in alignment with the fact that things are always changing. Living in alignment with that. Not trying to find a place that will never change. That may be possible, maybe, but aren't we finding that out? We're on that journey. But it's living with the truth of change. Living in alignment with that. That the mind rests in. That's where I find the rest in daily life. And living with the fact that because it's always changing, there's not going to be anything that's enduringly satisfying. So you give up looking for something that's enduringly, permanently satisfying. It's a big, big relief. And the mind, is it more peace then? And also living with the fact that there's no permanent core of any self anywhere. It's all these factors coming together moment by moment and then dissolving. And, we think there's a core because in one moment it seems that something is so solid and permanent, like even the knowing or consciousness itself. But it dissolves along with the object of what it has known. It takes some practice to see that, to realize that. But it's such a relief, that there's no permanent, solid self anywhere. And sometimes this sense of self is not to my liking, but it dissolves, something else comes up. Sometimes it's really good, but can't get attached to that either. That dissolves. So living with those truths is living in wisdom. And that's where the mind can find peace on an everyday level, and even on a deep level, sitting on the cushion. Living with the truth of anicca, the impermanence of anatta, the conditionality of everything arising and passing away, which leads to the understanding of no self, and the dukkha-ness, the unsatisfactoriness of life. So just in a nutshell, those are the wisdom teachings. And that's one wing of the Dharma. And to live with that wing of the Dharma, there needs to be a lot of compassion. Because you just can't do it with your head. If you try to do it with your head, you'll just get tied up in knots. You may be able to say something really intelligent, but once in a while you suffer. And your intelligence isn't going to get you out of that. You just need to open your heart to how it is. So compassion actually becomes the natural outgrowth of that wisdom. it's not easy to live in alignment with that, but it's possible and we can. So our hearts quiver because we open to the rawness of it, open to the first noble truth of all of that, and we open to the vulnerability of all that, the vulnerability of life as a human being. This is also wisdom. In recent times, I've had to deal with a couple of challenging people right in my home community. And this is life. I mean, I'm not exempt from that. It's actually activates a lot of possible stronger compassion, stronger awareness, deepening wisdom. But it also activates some anxiety, some ill will in the heart once in a while, momentarily. Even though knowing it doesn't last, it's still there. And then it comes again and comes again and comes again. And the tenderness which is possible to face that can be stronger than the hardness of it. That's what I've discovered, that the tenderness of compassion that's meeting the hardness of the heart can be more powerful than the ill will, where the energy doesn't have to sink into the ill will and just take off with that, you know. The energy can be more stabilized in the compassion for oneself, because there is momentarily that ill will there. Can you sense that there can be a shift from the energy being locked in to what the suffering is, and shifting towards the energy being more stabilized in the compassion towards that suffering? So it's stabilizing the energy in compassion itself. When I've reflected on how it is in this world, how the truth of suffering is just how it is in this world, my heart opens more and more with compassion. We're all in this vulnerable state, bound to the cycles of sickness, old age, and death. This is how it is. In our Buddhist tradition, we have to reflect on this over and over again. I am not free from old age, sickness, and death. This is part of life, of my life. Denying it is using an energy, that is useless. It's wasting the energy in denial. We need compassionate energy to open to that. And this is using our energy wisely and saying, this is true. This is how it is. To use our energy in a wise way with that. So there are two great constant companions of compassion. And one is loving kindness. That's the softness and the tenderness that can come with compassion, that softens our hearts to whatever is happening. There's not a pushback or resistance there. It's just a connection, which loving kindness is. It's connecting with it. It's softening. It's gentle around it. But there's also equanimity. And equanimity is described as that spacious openness of mind and heart that can hold everything. Can hold the joy and the sorrow. It can hold the pain and the pleasure. It can hold the, all the highs and the lows of life. So there's that bigness of heart. There's that bigness of mind. There's no separation. It's a boundaryless place. It's a boundless place. But equanimity is also stark. It's not soft and cuddly and loving, all the time. It's just starkly reflecting and saying, this is how it is right now. In a neutral way. It faces the outer life of the world and says, this is how it is right now in this world. It's not denying it or covering it up or repressing it in any way, but don't we need to accept it first before and take it all in and then get all the facts and then from there make a step? So unless we do that, we're just overlaying our concept of how we think it should be. So taking it all in and saying, this is how it is. It's stark. It's naked, like Agnes Au says. Said, seeing the world in its naked rawness. So these are the two constant companions of compassion, which are equanimity and loving kindness. The unconditional caring of loving kindness turned specifically towards what is difficult. So compassion really is loving kindness. It's just turned towards what's difficult to bear, whether it be in here or out there. That caring is fearless. It says, I can give my care to whatever is being faced right now in a way that is without exception. It's not separating my care and this difficulty. It's just bringing it all together unconditionally, with no need to, like, I'll do this for you if you do this for me. You just do it. You just give it. You just say it. You just maybe don't say it because that's more caring. Or you don't do it because that's more caring. So compassion in the world doesn't always have to do with action. We have to open to the truth and the fact and the reality of sometimes it has to do with inaction. That you don't take an action because you know it's going to be harmful. And so we often forget that. Or we don't say something because we know it's going to be harmful. So we give without regret, without agenda. We do what we can with no attachment to result. I came across this beautiful little story about a famous Argentine golfer, Roberto De Vicenzo. And this is a story about when he once won a tournament. And after receiving his check, smiling for the cameras, going to the clubhouse, preparing to leave, he later walked alone to his car, and approaching him was a young woman. She congratulated him on his victory and told him that her child was seriously ill and near death. De Vicenzo was touched by her story, took out a pen, endorsed his winning check for payment to the woman. So the story goes. And he says, make some good days for your baby. And he pressed the check into her hand. The next week he was having lunch in a country club when the official came to his table, PGA official, and said some of the guys in the parking lot saw you give this young woman your winnings after the tournament. And he said, well, I have news for you, the official said. She's a phony. She's not married. She has no sick baby. She fleeced you, my friend. And De Vicenzo said, you mean there's no baby who's dying? And the man said, that's right. And he said, that's the best news I've heard all week. Just the relief that, you know, there's no one dying, never mind the check. So his mind turned to that place all of a sudden. No regrets, he just gave. His heart was released. Whatever, if he had to forgive, it was there. Maybe there was no need to forgive anything. So in relationship to our own fears, our own inner experiences, it's not so easy to do that. I mean, maybe it's easy to say, yeah, wow, that was great. He did a wonderful job. But when it happens to us, we might not be able to be so accepting of how it goes in that way. it's hard to bring that tenderness of compassion to our painful experiences, our own painful experiences. The mental pain, pushing it away, you know, the mental pain, adding another layer of resistance there. The physical pain, too, is hard. In daily life or when we sit, it's there. It's hard to open to both. And a lot of times it's hard to even admit that we're hurting inside. Not too long ago, I have 3 granddaughters, and 2 of them are small. And the 2 of them that live on Maui, nearby me, 1 is 6 and 1 is 4. And the 4-year-old is a real rascal. She's the one that took on all the Filipino-looking traits of my family. And she's just a real cute little rascal. And the other one is, her mom is Japanese and Portuguese. And she is a very more reserved, and she looks very contemplative. And she's very sensitive. So they were outside, and they fell over on their wagon once. And the one girl came inside, the younger one, the rascal one, and she was going, "Ah, I hurt, you know, my knee hurts, something hurts, I've got a wound here and there." And so I went over to her and I said, "What's going on, Lauren? What's going on?" She said, "Grandma, Grandma, this got hurt, that got hurt. Get me some ice, you know, and kiss my owie." And so paying attention to her. And so that was done. And then I looked around and there was Emily. And Emily had quiet tears. And I went over to her and I said, "What's wrong, Emily? What's going on?" She said, "I'm hurt too." And I said, "Where? Where are you hurt?" And she said, "Here." You know, I felt sad, but I also felt so glad that she knew her heart, that she could say, "I'm hurt here, Grandma." That was big for me, you know. That was really big for me, that, you know, I had more tears of happiness that she could know that than tears in another way. So it's hard to go there for ourselves and to remind ourselves that we can soften around that, that we can go there, we can be there. It's okay to be there. There's this whole tangle of physical and mental pain that goes on, especially when we're quiet and we look inside. You know, how do we separate it out? Sometimes we feel the physical pain a lot, and, you know, we're trying to do something and move and relieve ourselves. Yeah, that's what we do. There's nothing wrong with that. But we don't realize that what's more painful is the mental pain. And for some of us, it's harder to go there. So just saying that that's a fact. I don't have all the remedies for it, but it's hard to go to the mental pain sometimes, the hurts that we feel. Even the resistance, the aversion towards the physical pain. Sometimes we don't realize that that's what's bothering us. It's not the actual physical pain. It's the aversion in the mind. So one time I asked Manindraji, my first Dharma teacher, "Why does it hurt so much?" And he said, "It's because your heart is disentangling. The tangle is disentangling." And so this is from the Samyutta Nikaya. "A tangle inside, a tangle outside. This generation is entangled in a tangle. I ask you, O Gotama, who can disentangle this tangle?" Someone asking the Buddha. And he said, "One established in virtue, wise, developing the mind and wisdom, one who is ardent and discreet, this person can disentangle the tangle." So remembering to bring tenderness, which is that loving kindness, which is compassion, to physical and mental experience that is painful, difficult to bear in ourselves. When we care for this on this inner ecology, there's a greater chance that we can truly care for that in the outer ecology. That moment that you mentioned, I'm just remembering where you said, oh, if I say, may you take care of yourself, then, oh, how will that affect me? Yeah? Maybe a moment of compassion came in. Maybe, I don't know, for yourself. Maybe it's some fear, but some compassion. How will that affect me? And then when you feel it for yourself, you can feel it for the other being. Ah, then you truly feel your authentic, yes, may you take care of yourself compassionately. So when we're drowning in it, when we're lost in it, in the suffering, this is what is called the near enemy of compassion, is when we're drowning in the suffering, when we're lost in it, when, you know, we're just, they call it in the scriptures grief, but it's unhealthy grief, because in our society, in the West, grief is healthy, you know, because grief is an acknowledgement that we're going through pain, and we face the pain. But when it goes overboard and we're lost in the pain, and we don't have that courage to really recenter our energy in the compassion for the pain, this is that unhealthy kind of grief, where it could also lead to self-pity. It could be pity for ourselves, it could be pity for another. So this is the near enemy of compassion. It can seem like compassion, but it's really not. There's a story in the scriptures also that makes a point of this. When someone is in quicksand and is getting pulled into the quicksand and is going to be smothered and die from it, you don't jump in the quicksand. You don't jump in that suffering with them and try to get them out. You'll never get them out. It's you stand on the side, really more feeling your center and your energy from the place of compassion and help that person. So it's not jumping into the quicksand, jumping into grief about the suffering. Recentering, redirecting your energy and being with the compassion for that grief. It's a great strength. How many times has it been for you, as it's been for me, where just being with a person, you know, a person is with all their grief and you're just there, as I was with my friend at the Bangkok airport. I told that story yesterday, didn't I? I can't remember where I am sometimes when I tell stories. When I could just be there and feel compassionate for her as she was going through what she was going through, that was the most healing thing for our relationship, you know, where just holding it. And sometimes you can just say to someone, oh, I'm sorry you feel that way, or I feel your pain. And that's the best thing that can happen in that moment. So we can get so bogged down in painful conditions of our life that, I want to make another point, that becomes our identity. You know, that I am my grief. I am my old story of whatever it is that made me this way. You know, parents, family of origin stuff, societal stuff. When we get bogged down in the identity that we've created for ourselves, which maybe has served us for a while, but, you know, there comes a point where being attached to our identity doesn't work anymore. How is that, you know? Where are you with that? Maybe you're not, but there are pieces of myself where I was the poor, you know, striving mother of three children for a long, long time. Oh, poor me. And that was my identity, you know. But now I can see it as it was just another time in my life. There are good stories that come out of that and good points I can make. But that was just another world then. And now it's different. So as William Stafford says, these stories can turn into pearls. They take on a luster. They accumulate as decorations, badges, earrings. You know? I mean, he said it in such a way that like wakes me up. You know, I don't want another badge of that identity. Oh, poor me. Sometimes we can use it wisely, but sometimes it's to our downfall. A solid sense of self is created. So what about the far enemy? I'm moving on here. The far enemy. The far enemy is cruelty. The cruelty of striking out, you know, when we're touched by or we're faced with something that's really hard for us. An event that happened in our lives, an unfortunate event. A drastic event, you know, a devastating event sometimes, or something that's happened to our loved ones. It's so hard. It is so, so hard to take that we strike out. You know, we say with our words, we do with our actions things that hurt ourselves more deeply than we know, and other people. And it happens. And that's the way it is. And we can make space for the fact that it does happen and not be unforgiving. But when it happens, can we learn from that and say, to continue this doesn't help? And then just see where we can know it before we lash out. And the next time not do that. So cruelty is lashing out at what is painful for us to open to. That's just one way. Pushing away, striking out. Sometimes it's cruelty to ourselves because, not only because that in itself is cruelty to ourselves, not just to others, but because sometimes we close down or turn away. We close up. And that's a cruelty to ourselves. We abandon what's really going on because we can't face it. And I must admit that sometimes that's a safety net. And sometimes we have to do that in order to keep sane and to keep balanced. Closing down is not always bad. It's helpful. But when we do it continually and make it a habit pattern, it's not so helpful. So when we notice that's always happening, we need support. We need help from others, someone that can help us, that can give us, share their energy with us so that we can open up more to what's hurtful. So cruelty is the far enemy. Judging, resentment, criticizing, this is cruelty to ourselves as well as others. Actress Susan St. James lost her 14-year-old in a plane crash. You may have heard this story. And after years of anguish and rage, she forgave or had compassion for everyone and everything that might be responsible for the accident. Her hard-earned observation was this: resentment is like taking poison and waiting for the other person to die. That really struck me when I heard it. Resentment, you know, it's hurtful to ourselves. So these are all areas where compassion can come in. Not overlaying or adding anything else, but not trying to figure it out, not trying to fix it. The first, you know, course of action is to be mindful of what's going on compassionately. Or be compassionate with what's going on, mindfully. Whichever way, whenever we face suffering, in the outer ecology or the inner ecology. So I'd like to end with this poem. A lot of you know it has such great mileage. this poem by Naomi Shihab Nye, Kindness. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. You must feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize or corn and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans that kept the simple breath in him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it with your voice until it catches the thread of all sorrows. And you see the hugeness of the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes real sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere like a shadow or a friend. So let's sit for a moment. May we touch into the aliveness of compassion in our hearts, and may that open us with courage to what's going on in the inner ecology and the outer ecology. Thank you for your attention to the Dharma.